not that comfortable. I see they've given me the graveyard shift. Are things going to happen behind me as I speak? Is that the intention? You mean I can trust you? Good. Well, thank you very much to the organisers for the invitation to be here. It didn't take much persuasion to come because I consider it to be a great opportunity and an important one. So thank you very much indeed. And thank you to Judy. And Judy, if I haven't addressed that last issue, I expect you to come back with that question at the end. Yeah, yes, please. There are a number of people I'd rather not be attacked by, and Judy's one of them, but anyhow, we'll give it a go. The media's secret agenda. The title of this talk is an absolute classic. It is not mine. It was given to me by the organisers. It assumes what it is meant to demonstrate. I don't like it in any case. It suggests that there's a media conspiracy and that I'm going to attack the media. It seems to be based on the idea that there is only one thing in any case called the media. In short, in typical media style, it gives us a headline which attracts, but which may have nothing to do with the substance of what follows. And it sets me up. Otherwise, it's good. In fact, that's why you're here after lunch, isn't it? Because you thought that was going to be the subject. That said, what on earth am I going to do? Well, it's obvious that one would redefine the topic to suit me and to ignore the organisers. Well, not quite. I am going to try to address what I think they're getting at, which is as follows. Let's look at the words secret and agenda for a moment. I think the point is, it seems to many of us at least, that in matters to do with faith, there is evidence of a consistently distorted media line. It seems to many of us that in matters to do with faith, there is evidence of a consistently distorted media line. If so, yes, it is secret, because most people in the media are quite unaware of it themselves. That is, it's not a secret conspiracy, but it could be a largely unconscious element of behaviour in the media. Yeah, secret in that sense, maybe so. And then it's an agenda because it's consistent. It tells the same story each time. Not an agenda because it's a worked out, planned agenda, but agenda in the sense of you can see it fairly consistently occurring, this business of, in matters to do with faith, there's evidence of a consistently distorted media line. Now, to examine these matters may help you to be aware of them as media people and perhaps be able to correct the balance. Always, however, of course, in favour of truth and fairness. That's your business. I'm impressed talking from time to time with Christian journalists on Christian subjects, and I don't think I've ever been let down yet. I've never felt that the person interviewing me is in my pocket. I've always received just as hard a time from the Christian journos as from anyone else, and they certainly don't write what I would want them to write by any means, necessarily. I believe that your duty is to the truth and to fairness, not to be cozy with certain persons. Why am I saying this? All right. To begin, however, let's put the discussion in its proper context. God and his chosen media. Christianity is a book religion. It relies on language, on words. Think about how God reveals himself. It's true that he reveals himself in the created world around us, in its beauty, its power, its complexity, its design. But if that was the whole revelation of God, the created world around us, then we'd be in big trouble for two reasons. First, because it's insufficient. God has created us to be relational creatures. We long for union with each other. We want to remain distinct, we want to remain our own person, and yet to be united in doing things, in seeing things together, to be united by friendship, by affection, and by love means something to us. Far better for us to come together here and sit in the same hot room, listening like this, than to have the whole thing in our houses and all us being independent from one another. Coming together is human. And integral to the whole business of coming together as human beings is the word. words of truth, words of affection, words of promise, words of correction, words of invitation, words of admiration, words of encouragement. You know, it's a great affliction to be blind, but it is as great an affliction to be deaf, because deafness cuts you off from words, and words are the vehicles of relationship. When God reveals himself to us, it's not simply a matter of him telling us things about himself. Nature might have been sufficient for that. You could look at nature and say, wow, he must be a great God and a very wonderful God. But that's not sufficient. God wants to speak to us in order to establish a fitting relationship with him, a friendship in which, of course, he's the senior partner. It's no accident that the Son of God is called the Word of God, his Logos. If you don't express your Logos in the old way of thinking, unexpressed Logos is reason. You've still got it in your mind. Express your Logos and it becomes speech. God is a speaking God, and he designed words to be the means of communication between persons. Now, the second reason why natural revelation, the revelation in the natural order, is insufficient is because our reception of the revelation of nature is distorted. There's nothing wrong with the revelation itself. It tells the truth. There's no doubt about that. But God's a great communicator, a perfect communicator. The problem is with us. When Adam sinned on our behalf, he put himself and his family outside the garden. When God spoke to him face to face, it was in the garden, not outside. In the world outside the garden, free, so he thought, free from the authority of God's word, which he was chafing under, he became enslaved three times over to his own fallen nature, to cosmic evil, and to human communal wrong, what the Bible calls the world, the flesh, and the devil. Human beings are triply enslaved, although we think that we are free. Adam and his successors rejoice in a spurious freedom, a freedom marked by an unspoken addictiveness, an addictiveness to sin. The great Bible story of the Tower of Babel is a constant reminder to us about human speech. Humans love fellowship. We love society. Outside the garden, our love, like much else, is distorted. The men of the Tower of Babel unite in a sort of a false fellowship in order to assault God's authority. God punishes them by confusing their languages, causing an even greater experience of human alienation, not only from him but from one another. The cultural divisions of humankind, over which there is so much misunderstanding and hatred and bloodshed, arise from our alienation from God, the very centre of our being. We were designed to be united to God in love. That's what you were designed to be. That's the plan for you, to be united with God in love. We spurned him, and we now pay the penalty in our disengagement from the centre of things and also from one another. We cannot hear his message in this world. Instead, we habitually take parts of the world and we worship them. Our idolatry is a testimony to the need we have to be united with God and yet the fact that we're alienated from him. We'd rather be in charge of our gods instead of submitting to the one true God. That's human nature. Ironically, of course, once we set up idolatry, we find ourselves dominated by the gods we choose. You only have to see how addictive and spiritually crippling the power of money is and the power of shopping. Money in action. But God still speaks. Remember, words are his chosen way of relationship, of relating to us. Ultimately, he sent his Son into the world, his word into the world, to speak to us, and when he came, he spoke words of grace and truth. True and gracious words create trust, and trust is the very essence of relationship. I'll say it again. Trust is the very essence of relationship. You cannot really love a person unless you can trust them. If you've ever tried to live with a liar for any length of time, you'll know how impossible it is for love to be sustained. You can't trust a liar, and lying destroys relationships, because trust is the essence of relationship. God's speech is typically very promise-filled. He's a promising God. Promises are wonderful things, if you think about them for a moment. You know, we have no control over the future. Promises control the future. Promises are always forward-looking, and they control that great unknown chaotic flux that's coming towards us called the future. Promises make the future known when it's all unknown. Promises make the future stable. Promises deal with our anxieties. The promises of God above all, because his promises are always true. But that is why in setting up the most fundamental of human relationships, of man and woman in marriage, they exchange promises. Very interesting to see the sort of promises people make up these days and how pathetic they are. Absolutely extraordinary. They cannot trust each other. I met a psychiatrist recently, not professionally, and I said to him, what is the... why not too, I might add, psychiatrist. All of us have needs from time to time. Okay, but it wasn't professional in this case. I asked him, what was he seeing in his surgery? What was he seeing in his consulting rooms? He said, it is the age of anxiety. He said, anxiety disorders are very prevalent. I said, why is that? He said, because people can no longer trust each other's promises. Very interesting. And of course, if trust is the essence of relationship, trust is built on promises. Trust is built on words. If you can't trust words, if words crack and fall and break and are no longer trustable, I don't know if there's a word called trustable, but why not, then of course you can't have relationships. Our relationships with God are marked by faith, hope, which is just faith looking forward, and love. It is a relationship in, once again, God is God as he ought to be in our lives, and in which we are his servants, in which he has authority, which once we contested in the Garden of Eden. Now, that's what God's words are like. Therefore, that's what our words should be like. His are pure, true, trustworthy, reliable, inviting, correcting, fearless, enlightening. You could extend the list about what God's words are like. They're drawn from God by his love of the other person. He speaks because there is a person there, and he speaks to the person. The problem lies in our threefold enslavement to what the Bible calls the world, the flesh, and the devil. In particular, the Bible refers to the evil one as the father. Note this. Just think about it. Remember what it calls him? The father of lies. Very interesting. The father of lies. The evil one is a malign spirit whose business it is to darken our understanding and corrupt our relationships. When you see slander, malice, and falsehood, when you see relationships corrupted, you may be sure that the evil one is there somewhere. But that's not all. Just as at the Tower of Babel, men united together to assault God's authority, so too now human beings unite against the truth. They do it instinctively. They unite against the truth. We often do this unconsciously by accepting the fashions of the day, by believing the intellectual fashions of the day, by believing corporate falsehood, by sheer laziness as we take what we're told without checking the facts. From such worldliness comes evil such as racism and prejudice, but so too come the intellectual faults by which we accept an ideology as an excuse for thinking. We are victims of the cliché in our dealings with other people and with each other. Now, what can we learn from what I've said so far? Four things. What can we learn from what I said so far? Four things. Ready? First, words matter immensely. They are integral to the very pattern that God has set up for human existence and especially relationships. They are a delight in themselves and they are a source of delight. Second, meaning matters. Words are wonderfully flexible, but they're not capable of just any old interpretation. The fact is that God uses human words to establish his relationship with us and to encourage each other to relate to one another. Thus, although words can be terribly abused, and are frequently, they can also do extraordinary good, especially when we recognize they come from an author who means what he says and expects us to understand what he says. The whole business of suspecting all words and giving the recipient as sources of power over us, all that sort of postmodern interpretative stuff, is a blatant attempt to deny people, to deny the priority and power of God's words. They really come, in a sense, from atheism. We deny his authority over our lives when we deny his words. Third, the abuse of words is typical of our human fallen state. If you are in the word business, it's a dangerous job. The Bible is very strong on the inability we have to tame the tongue. It says, I quote, "It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison." That's the Bible's estimate of the tongue. We can never get this right in a post-Babel world, although we are to strive for good speech in all things, for the higher standards of speech. Is speech in particular, we must learn to love the neighbour. Fourth, God tells us, by your words you will be judged. To us they may be just passing things, ephemeral things. What is more ephemeral and lightweight than a set of words? They pass, we forget them. God does not forget them. We are accountable for what we do with words and for all our words. Don't look on approval from those around you in the end, as professional people. Look for God's approval. His approval is the only one that's going to matter in the final analysis. A friend of mine was teaching nurse education, and he said to me that nurses in their educational procedure pass through three stages. The first stage, you're all fingers and thumbs, and you're terribly self-conscious as you deal with the patients. Something wrong? Oh, good. The second stage, you get beyond that, and now you become conscious of the doctors and the other nurses. You're very conscious of how your peers look upon what you're doing. And then, he said, you pass to the third stage when your real interest is in the patient and you're really concerned for her well-being. And I said, and how long does it take through to get through to the third stage? He said, most people never make it. That makes you think. Of course, in the hospital you go to, that's not true. But most of us write for our peers. That is what's important to us, their approval. And there's no harm in that in one way. How else can we judge ourselves? But in the final analysis, our accountability is to God. And we must write under his eye. For he says, by your words you will be judged. Well, that's my talk on, what was the subject? The media secret agenda. Now, I've got a bit more time apparently, so I'm going to sort of back this up a bit with something called my experience of the alleged secret agenda. And here are a few, what you've heard so far is what really matters. Now here are some footnotes. Okay? Now, I've always been an interested consumer of the media, especially the news and commentary elements of it, opinion pieces. Like all users, I have my opinions about its quality and my strong preferences between print, radio, the web, and TV. I can certainly give you a whole lot of clichés, furthermore, about the media. When we non-media types get together and start talking about you, believe me, the clichés flow fast. But you know that, and in fact all sections of society are summed up in clichés one way or another. The banks are always uncaring. The police are always corrupt. The uranium industry is always nasty. The politicians are always venal. The churches are always hypocritical. The clichés flow. And I won't say what they say about the press, the media. What is important, of course, in this post-Babel world is that we have free speech and a free press. Actually, having a free press and free speech is both necessary and impossible, in my view, but it remains our aim. Now, of course, I'm not merely a consumer. Although you may not immediately think of this, the pulpit was a key medium at various stages in history, and I would say it still is, but in a reduced way. The pulpit was contested at various times by governments wanting to get a message out and preachers wanting to say their piece. In the days of King James I of England and the Sixth of Scotland, the same man, he wanted his subjects to practice their archery, I think it was, on Sundays. So he sent round a letter to all the... I hope I've got this story right. I didn't check it up. But he sent round a letter to all the clergy that they were to read in the pulpit on a Sunday, encouraging people to engage in sports on Sundays. One clergyman read out the king's letter, which he was bound to do, and said, "You have heard the word of man, now hear the word of God," and proceeded to read the Ten Commandments. James's activity was called tuning the pulpits, because the pulpits were highly significant in that day and age as a medium. The freedom of the pulpit actually matters a great deal to all of us, including, I would say, unbelievers. At least with the pulpit, there is the possibility of a widespread local opinion being generated, not owned by magnates or governments, if ever we should reach the need for such a stage. What I've said about God the communicator is absolutely crucial for the conduct of Christian communications, of course. Since becoming Archbishop of Sydney in 2001, I have, for the first time in my life, had regular contact in a professional way with what you may call the mainstream media. The experience has had its high points and its low points. But as I observe the way in which the media operates, I don't think I'm either a special victim or a special hero. The media is doing its job according to its own lights and in accordance with a number of restrictions which the ordinary person may hardly be aware of. On the other hand, it seems to me that some of these restrictions are a bit self-imposed and unnecessary, and I want to question why some of them exist. Remember that I'm suggesting that in matters to do with faith, there is a consistently distorted media line. Now, what do I mean by that? Why does it occur, and what can be done to help? What do I mean? Why does it occur? What can be done to help? First, why? Why would there be a consistently distorted media line in matters of faith? One of my most memorable moments as Archbishop was talking to a particularly proficient journalist. After finishing the story, I can't remember what it was about, she asked me whether there was anything I would like to add to the story. "Yes," I said, "I would like to add that I love Jesus and that he loves the world." I think that's what I said. She laughed in a sort of tinkling way and said, "They'd never print that, Archbishop." I thought that was a funny story, but I can see that you don't think it was. Now, thank you, Judy. Judy says every person in the room's conscience is now struck. Well, she didn't say that, but it's a sort of thing. Now, it is only a story. It is only a story. But I have to say, in 4 years being Archbishop, and with contact with the media almost every week, it encapsulates a whole range of experiences. If there is a story to do with the churches, it is what we do or what we fail to do, but it is never or rarely ever about what we believe. Again and again, I have had God and Jesus omitted from what I say to the media. Now, I've tried always to include, if possible, something about God, Jesus, and the Bible in what I'm saying. It is extraordinary what pains are taken sometimes by cutting sentences fore and aft to bring out just a set of words in the middle in order to avoid the spooky bits. Or not reported at all, as in a state funeral, for example, where I was the preacher and all sorts of things were reported about the state funeral, but not a word, as I remember, about the sermon at the state funeral. Well, of course, you know, why would you? Well, why wouldn't you? It was part of the funeral. I remember that. Now, actually, there was a report of it. I fib. A Melbourne journalist referred to it. He said, I won't tell you who it was. He said, "Then the Archbishop preached on eternity and it seemed as long." The sermon went for 11 minutes, but that was it. I know. The eulogy went for 20, I know, but anyhow, there we go. It is as if, since journalists may be uncomfortable with such concepts as God, Jesus, and the Bible, talk about them is not reported. The result is that religion is turned into its social function, that the worth or otherwise of what is said and done is measured by its possible social impact or political impact, and the capacity to give offence or to cause conflict. Of course, choirs are a hardy perennial in the media. The number of stories about church choirs goes on and on. You would think that churches were either political pressure groups or conflicted, failing organisations, from the impression you'd have of media overall. That's my view. One result has been that Christian spokespersons, knowing that they have no chance of talking about Christianity, adopt self-censorship. They become even more desperate to be at least part of society and to have their heads above the parapet, so to speak, and so they themselves omit any reference to what they believe, to matters to do with faith, God, the Bible, etc. That is what I mean by a distortion of the news. Christian ethics, for example, are not secular ethics. They come straight out of what God has said and done. To remove Christian ethics from that source is not merely to distort them, it's to destroy them. So yeah, sure, I might talk about the current IR legislation that is going to come to us. I talk about the impact that it might have on people's time and the weekend and so forth and so on. But I'm doing so because I believe in a God of relationships, a God who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and who has created us for relationships and puts relationships higher than mere money-making. Now, if I am reported simply as talking about weekends, and this other surrounding material is edited out, then what I am saying is not merely distorted, it's destroyed. It makes it sound as though I am a mere secularist, saying what all the secular people may say. Vaguely, as they've pigeonholed so many Christian speakers, sort of vaguely wet left wing, always again the government types. Useful for a quote if you can't find someone else. Now that's what I mean by a distortion of the news. Christian ethics are not secular ethics. They come straight out of what God has said and done. To remove them from that context is not merely to distort them, it is to destroy them. I'm repeating myself, but it's a very good sentence. At this level, the consequence has been that God talk has been effectively banished from public life. You cannot speak about God, and you cannot show how belief in him is rational and leads to rational and beneficial social consequences. Now, I want you to admit something to me. Just say you were given the terrible job, can you imagine, of reporting on this session. You're about to write it up or you're about to interview me. You've worked out your questions. You know what you're going to say. Now, I want you to admit the following, that if you were going to report this address, you would have ignored the first part, the God part, entirely. The part I said was the main part, the most important part. You would ignore it entirely. You'd only be interested in the second part of what I'm saying. Excuse me of accusing you of this, but long experience makes me think it likely. But I'm the author. I regard the first part as what I really want to say today, with this part as a footnote. That's what I said it was. Why don't you believe me? Surely your job is to make the report interesting enough for the first part to be included. If you don't think it's terribly interesting, make it interesting. With justice, of course. Otherwise, are you really reporting? In any case, why is the God part of no interest to you? Why are you so sure that ideas and even theological ideas are of no interest to listeners or readers? Wouldn't they expect me to say something about them? Don't they expect me to talk about them? Well, why would they not expect you to report that I've talked about them? Furthermore, I think often the media, undervalues the intellectual capacity of readers to engage with ideas and beliefs and to have that material placed before them. Now, there was today a... today and yesterday, brilliant, because there was a piece in the Herald in the Sydney this morning and a piece in the Age yesterday, written by senior people, which I've now lost, not the people, the pieces. We all really ought to set this as a little bit of work for you guys to do, to read what Pamela Bone in The Age says in her piece, Religion, Good and Bad, and Don Watson, isn't it? Can't see the name here, but Don Watson, that's right. Don Watson says about Peter Costello here. It'd be really worthwhile studying this material here. I don't know Pamela Bone, but I presume it refers to her here as... an associate editor of The Age. Don Watson refers to Mr. Houston here, not by name, but he says, he talks about the way in which the Hillsong, the head honcho at, yes, here it is, the church's head honcho, he says, I think he means Mr. Houston, holds to the ancient belief that it's okay for Christians to get rich. While it has always required a considerable imaginative feat to find evidence of this in the Gospels, in the real world it's overwhelming. Well, okay, fair enough in this article, I guess, but would it not be right for someone to investigate what Brian Houston really thinks about all this and to talk about it? There are ideas there that are interesting. And just a sort of a snide comment as you go by is not an engagement with the ideas that you might expect and hope for. I might refer to those articles again if time permits a little later. Well, one result has been that for many citizens of Australia who actually have a faith, not just Christianity, of course, there are many citizens of faith, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists and others, the media itself has become a foreign country. It spends vast amounts of time talking about sport, finances, weather, lifestyle, health, fashion, relationships, astrology even. But it only talks about religion from time to time, perhaps increasingly, let me say, but it does not talk about religion in a way which is recognisable or sympathetic to the ordinary Christian practitioner. The media may talk about religion, but it doesn't talk about my religion, if I can put it like that, my faith. There are hundreds of thousands of Australians, perhaps more, who cannot find the central fact of their lives dealt with in a recognisable or sympathetic form in the media. At best, when we talk about God and the Spirit and Jesus, the media insists on turning it into politics and social impact. Family first. Rise of the neocons. The religious right. I wonder, in purely commercial terms, by the way, whether the media can afford to be a foreign country to so many people. The difficulty is exacerbated when religion in the media falls exclusively into the hands of Christians of a liberal persuasion. That liberal Christians have an honoured role to play in the media, I have no doubt. But it must be remembered that liberal Christianity has its own way of viewing the world, and this often includes a very unsympathetic account of both so-called conservative, Protestant, and Roman Catholic Christians, not to mention Pentecostals. The mere fact that a person is a Christian doesn't mean they're exempt from having their prejudices. Once again, it is frequently hard for readers and listeners to recognise themselves via the liberal Protestants who often dominate the waves, or to have their point of view honoured, although in terms of size, they are far more numerous than liberal Christians. And from the point of view of history and the Bible, they are far closer to what most Christians have always believed and do now believe. Let me add a very important rider to what I've just said. And I want you to hear this well and truly. I believe that if there is a consistent distortion, it's by no means universal. And it seems to be improving. That is to say, the distortion seems to be lessening. If I may speak personally, I continue to have had a significant number of strongly positive experiences with the secular media, where I felt without doubt that I was able to say what I wanted to say and in my own terms. I was not always comfortable. The results may not have always have been pretty. People may not have felt that they liked what I had to say or what I was forced to say by a good journalist. But I have no doubt at all, in quite a number of cases that I can think of easily, that I was given a fair go by senior members and others, of course, of the media, within the constraints that media has. It seems to me that the instinctive media unwillingness to allow us to speak about God and spiritual matters is lifting. I may be wrong, but that's my sense. And some very senior journalists are leading the way in this, not necessarily Christians. I'm also delighted to have been asked to give the Boyer Lectures this year, which is a media event, and given for the first time, or actually for the second time, to a Christian theologian in the 50 years. And of course, it will not surprise you to hear that I intend to talk about Jesus. Thank you, ABC. And why not ABC? I take it the ABC is not a Jesus-free zone. But that I have been asked should not surprise us. Theology too has its place in the national discussion table. The so-called separation of church and state in no way precludes that and never has. Now I come to the why question. Why is it that there's this distortion, if I'm right? Well, the situation is complex and involves, among other things, technical issues which you will know far more about than I do. Thus, even a sheer amateur like me can see that journalism and media work is not easy. To state the obvious, limitations of space and time make the work fiendishly difficult. I'm really amazed at how well people do so often with what we give them, so to speak. And I'm often amazed and pleased with how media have presented my point of view under the constraints of time and space. It's all very well for me to want to be reported in a balanced way, but media has obligations to be both interesting and brisk. It's not always possible to put everything I say in. Another point I have noticed is that the final story in newsprint does not actually belong to anyone. I know that the journalist's name may well be attached, but someone else has put the all-important headline on, and the headline is so often the story. It is as if each story in the news has its own life. It doesn't actually belong to anybody. As well, the source of the story may not be very adept at putting over their point of view, and the media person may be stuck with a very bad source. Well, that's not media's fault. The result is, of course, that many people are dissatisfied with the media. The sense that your special interest is especially being picked on, that religion is the victim of the media and so forth, is pervasive throughout society. For example, in talking to a senior military officer, I became aware that the armed forces are not always happy with the treatment they receive. It was all mirror image of the sort of things church people talk about. The stories about the military always seem to be about defective weapons, ballooning costs, or soldiers misbehaving. No doubt, that's not a true picture, but it's true enough of the experience they have of the media. And I suppose if you talk to anyone else, from Freemasons, builders, doctors or undertakers or teachers, they'll all have their media stories about the way in which the media mistreats our profession or whatever it is, and that there is a systematic distortion of realities. So I need to be careful in talking to you about this subject today to signal that I'm fully aware, not as fully as you are, of course, I'm fully aware of the technical difficulties of your profession and the fact that many people feel much the same about the way they're treated too. And it's very often just the way it is. So I agree with all that. But that doesn't help me much with the problems faced by religion. Insofar as the distortion is a reality, and I think it is, it does actual damage to institutions and to people, and it breaks down community. I could detail actual harm done by persistent media distortion, as you would expect from the fact that we need to rely on each other and truth is integral to trust. Persistent media distortion has broken trust and broken friendships. God calls upon us for the highest standards of probity. We ourselves are not able to sustain them because we have rejected his authority, but we ought to aim at them. That said, there are some further observations about how things actually work and how it feels to be the subject of media attention. And I've noticed the following difficulties. How are you going out there? Bit tired yet? The end is in sight. No, it's a fair way off yet. Never mind. Just do the best you can. That gentle sleepiness that creeps over us from the back. Okay, here we go. Here are some of the difficulties I've experienced. Ready? First, sheer ignorance. Especially when dealing with generalists, I mean the generalist journalist who comes and they've been detailed to do a story and they've got no particular religious background. It is too much to expect a generalist to have a close knowledge of a subject, fair enough. But sometimes I have to say the sheer ignorance of reporters is a concern. They do not know the first thing about Christianity, about history, about the church, or about the issue. Sometimes I have to explain what an archbishop is, where we are, what we're doing here, before we ever got onto the subject of Arianism or whatever it is we've come to talk about. Now, they're only doing their job. And their job, of course, involves all sorts of similar situations where they've got to go and talk to a fire chief about fires and so forth, and what do they know about that? But I have to say, from a point of view of person in the limelight at this point, it is frustrating to have to explain the basics so that a story can even be told. And the distortion is almost inevitable. I don't think I blame the person at that point. It's just inevitable because they don't know enough. The case is usually otherwise, let me say, with specialist religion reporters. Unfortunately, I cannot say always the case, but there are some fine religion reporters around the traps, and I think that the media is beginning to recognise the importance of this subject and to dedicate specialists to it. Good. If that is so, however, let me say that they cannot afford to deploy people with no first-hand experience of their subject, any more than you'd make a tennis correspondent out of someone who never went to a tennis match, never plays tennis, and hates going and watching them. Well, we've had that sort of thing in religion reporting. It certainly has the effect of turning religion into politics, since a journalist like that will be interested in politics. Mind you, religion has its politics, and that's fair game too, as long as it is balanced reporting in the broader context of the ideas that have created the politics, not just politics for the sake of politics. I've noticed this problem, however. Owing to the speed with which journalism is conducted, there is a tendency to simply consult the files and build a story on what the media outlet said last time, whether it was accurate or not. I would add to this, sometimes when I've complained after the fourth time, they've said, well, you didn't complain the first time. But if I complained the first time for every time the facts have been inaccurate, I'd spend my days talking to media outlets. I would add to this the deployment of the dreaded cliche, which really makes me cross. I realise that the journalist has to create a picture in a few words. Nuance is not a concept which comes easily. And yet, the continual use of adjectives to pigeonhole conservative, fundamentalist, liberal, hardline, extremist, moderate, once bestowed, never retracted, is irritating in the extreme. It is shoddy. It is lazy journalism. It makes the task of actually listening to what is said impossible because you know in advance what this sort of person will say. I got it out of the files. Furthermore, it all goes to build up the cardboard image of a person, often untrue in fact, but an easy target for adverse or positive comment, either, and an easy foil when a story has to be done at speed. It's hard not to think of the media as having constructed the good guys and the bad guys for easy reference, with never mind what the issues really are. You may see that I'm slightly irritated by that bit. Second, history. One of the reasons why religion is not reported on well is that the history of religion in our nation. Sectarian controversies, especially between Catholic and Protestant, were so fierce and frequently so painful in family life that there grew up from the 1920s and 30s onwards a sort of tacit agreement not to talk about religion. As my dad said when I went to the golf club, joined the golf club as a 16-year-old, never talk about religion, never talk about politics. That was the rules amongst the chaps in those days. It was chaps. This extended to the media, namely, don't talk about religion, and the blame lies with the churches themselves, which did not practice speaking the truth in love. We have a lot to be ashamed of in the churches. A great deal more could be said about this, but it's important to note that here is an important aspect of what has led to this sort of present unofficial censorship of religious ideas. However, it does give media outlets an excuse to leave us well enough alone. They feel instinctively that to try to judge between religious disputes is beyond them. It's better not even to enter into theology. But this, of course, means that talk about God becomes mere opinion and can't be tested in the arena of fact. So I want to make sure that we know that there's a complex story here, and it's not all media is bad at this point. Well, I hope you don't hear me saying that in any case today. Third, and most important, that's wrong, isn't it? I should have put this in the headline. Okay. Well, there we go. Are you ready? Third and most important, secularism. Once again, this is a complex historical phenomenon. To do it justice would require an examination of such matters as the history of left-wing politics, the nature of the social legacy of the 1960s, the most important decade in the 20th century in cultural matters, I think, and the impact of migration and multiculturalism. Suffice to say that since the 1960s in particular, there's come a growing assumption that we live in a secular society. And by secular, we mean no room for God. That's why we can't talk about him. Furthermore, this is not just an assumption. For a number of people, and not least the people who work in the knowledge industries like you, this has become a creed. It's not just an assumption that you learn and assume. It's a creed. You will find in the media, in the universities, in the schools and elsewhere, missionaries for secularism. In their view, to quote a friend of mine who works in the media, faith is a private thing not to be mentioned in public life. If it does come into public life, it only leads to evangelical fundo-fascism and all terrorism. Another carefully nuanced analysis of the situation. Now note this. Secularism thinks of itself as the new righteousness. It is righteous because it is inclusive of many people, not exclusive like religion. It is righteous because it backed the winning causes of the 1960s, such as abortion reform, censorship repeal, and feminism, again, unlike many of the churches. It is righteous because it alone is neutral. You do not have any faith commitments to be a secular person, and therefore you can hold the ring and determine what's right and wrong because you're neutral. It is righteous because it stands for general values such as tolerance and a fair go and mateship, rather than restrictive values such as love and self-sacrifice. It is righteous because it is so intellectually superior to any religion. Finally, it's the future because all religions, except perhaps new spiritualities, are passing away and we will soon arrive at a Christless nirvana. Naturally, I would contest all those statements. Religion, good and bad. Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities, said Voltaire. The books of the major religions contain passages that are absurd and worse than absurd. What are today's kindly Christians to make of the instructions to genocide in the Bible? Quote, now kill all the boys and kill every woman who has slept with a man, but save for yourselves every girl who has never slept with a man, Numbers 31. What do religious believers do about the sins of Scripture? Fortunately for the rest of us, they politely ignore them. Religious extremists might believe in the absurdities, but most people do not. Karl Marx described religion as the sigh of the oppressed creature, the opiate of the people. If he was right, it would imply that when people were not poor and oppressed, they wouldn't need the opiate of religion. Yet while societies grow richer and freer, religion persists. But what sort of belief? In numerical terms, religious belief is growing because it is strong in highly populated, poor countries. But it's weak in most modern democracies. In Britain, the proportion of those stating no religion has grown from 31 to 44% in the last 20 years, etc. What about America, then? One doesn't quite know what to make of America. I would say, with very significant exceptions, that a number of my media experiences are based on secularist assumptions about religion, about me, and about the church. It gives the media person the high moral ground, and it makes it very hard for them to listen to or to my discussion or counter points of view. A very interesting little discussion with a on the telephone with a reporter recently. Obviously, as are all reporters, highly intelligent and engaged, younger than me by some considerable way. And it was about women bishops, hot subject, and very, you know, I'm culturally absolutely dinosauric on that matter. And something she said made me say to her, "You're committed to the other side of this," or words to this effect. She said, "Oh, no, this is a story, I'm completely without bias." Then I repeated back to what she said, and she had the grace to say, "No, that does reflect my view. Thank you." In the conversation, no, she was very good. I thought she was very professional. And in the conversation, we went on a little bit, and she said, "But fathers can be mothers," she said. I said, "I thought that was difficult." But it was an expression of her strong point of view, which she'd allowed to come out in this matter until checked. And she admitted it. I appreciate her professionalism. But again and again I've noticed in conversation with media persons that they adopt the high moral ground. It leaves them open to the temptation we all experience to replace argument with a sneer. Not everyone finds fundamentalism miserable, nonsensical, and offensive. But everyone should be concerned about religion's encroachments on political debate. Far from regenerating a country, all the evidence suggests it perverts policy, stymies democracy, and stunts moral and intellectual growth. No, it's a sneer. It's a sneer. It's not an argument, it's a sneer. And I'm sorry, it happens more often than I would wish, if I can put it like that. Let me say, we live in a fallen world. All our speech is corrupt. And I've done the same thing myself, I'm sure. So please bear that in mind. We're looking for what's best here. We're not necessarily, you know, out there throwing stones, etc. In the end, secularism, however, is self-defeating. By pigeonholing evangelicals or Catholics or Pentecostals, by using nasty words, by sometimes creating hatred against us, by the way, they are alienating whole segments of society. More, they are refusing to talk seriously to and of the very people who do so many of the voluntary good works in this society. Did you know that? It's the churches who do the good works, overwhelmingly in our society, and the evangelical and strong Roman Catholic churches that do it, and Pentecostals. More, if I may say so, persons who write like that are making themselves utterly foolish by being so ignorant of the highly significant moral and philosophical underpinnings of the positions which they so casually trash. You get the impression sometimes that they are the very first persons to think of a particular difficulty in the Christian position. Oh, yes, let me quote Numbers 31 saying, kill. Oh, yes, Christians have never thought of that. Well, we've had 2,000 years of thinking of that, and we have our answer to that, as you might have if you've been reading the Bible for 2,000 years, not personally. You get the impression sometimes that they are utterly oblivious of the fact that Christians, including some of the greatest minds of people that have ever lived in East and West, have been thinking about these things for a couple of millennia. But the matter goes even deeper. It is not as though we are dealing with uneducated media people. There's probably never been better educated media people than there are now, in a formal sense. But I wonder often, does this education have a strong historical component? Are you aware, for example, of the extent to which Christianity has impacted this country of ours, and mainly for good? Professor Jeffrey Blaney's view is Christianity in its heyday probably did more for Australia than any other single institution. Now, I can't blame media about this because historians have been blind to it. They've come to history with secularist assumptions. They don't believe what people say, why they do things, and they've missed it. However, it is being redressed, I'm glad to say. Australia may be a secular state under some definitions, but it's not and never has been a secular community. Think of it. Secularism does not even see what it is in the past. It is as if there is an incredible blindness. In Duntroon Military College, in the mess hall at Duntroon, you go up the stairs and on the left there's a photo of a letter from the Queen in which she gives the colours to the regiment. And she speaks about the way in which the colours have been blessed and they are to regard themselves as Christian soldiers. This is in 1957. Since when did Australia cease to be able to use such language? I don't believe we are a secular community. But if you believe that, you'll be blind. I do not believe, therefore, secularism does not even see what is in the past. It is as if there is an incredible blindness. I don't believe, therefore, no one did, and those who did were either hypocrites or fools. That's the assumption. But within the ambit of modern humanities courses, such ideologies as those which promote suspicion of words molest the text before the text molests you, they say, actually bind you into a little cell of inability to listen to what others are saying. They make you suspicious of other people, suspicious of power relationships. And it's no accident that so much secularism is anti-marriage and anti-family. It is the age of the individual. They lock us into little anxious cells in which we can never trust others and never trust others' language. That's how we're trained. So what can be done? I'm not despairing. I think the Christian churches have been asleep for decades, but there are stirrings. No good blaming the media for what amounted to an intellectual capitulation by the churches. Media outlets do not owe us a living. But the stirrings are not simply a matter of church leaders doing things differently. Christian men and women have to ask for something better from the media. How will they know what we want if we're silent? If we're not happy for Christmas to be de-Christianized, we need to say so. Likewise, and more importantly, Easter. Likewise, those who work in the media should not be satisfied with the husks of secularism. Having the secularists in charge of media outlets is like having the tone deaf in charge of the orchestra. There is so much more of life which they don't get. They can't see it. It will be important for you to understand the glories of the Christian faith. Important for you as a media person to be well trained in your Bible and in Christian theology and in Christian history. Our churches have failed to educate their lay people, and we can hardly blame others for our ignorance. Give depth to media presentation on religious issues. And give religious depth to the presentation of all issues. I don't mean you should give Christians an easy time or let mistakes in the churches go unremarked. Critical writing is a Christian thing. On the other hand, there is no need to be an unwitting accomplice to a secular view of the world. Go back to the important part of this address. Remember the beginning. Modern society exhibits all the failings that God's word says it would. We find language difficult. We're having trouble bonding in a healthy way. We're having trouble finding love. Our individualism is killing us. God has created us to be relational creatures and has given us language as a means of communication. But there are words that we can trust in this world. God has put His words into our history. His words are in the Bible. He has demonstrated that even human language can be used as an instrument of love and fulfilling relationships. The best thing to do as a media person is simply to be a Christian person. Use language naturally, truthfully, lovingly, as God intended you to use it. The media's secret agenda? I don't think there is such a thing, really. Although I can see various reasons for distortion in the media workplace, and some of it is caused by a sort of resolute missionary secularism, which is assumed often rather than proved, and which does damage not only to the Christian faith, but also to the community as a whole. That's it.
Before I say anything else, I'd like to say God, Jesus, Bible. I think it's important to say that up front. You'll be happy to know, Peter, that you answered my question, so I won't be asking it again. And I think those of us who have written about Christian issues and news in the media know how often issues, statements of belief, even the word Jesus gets edited out or dismissed by the news desk. It's a challenge to us to engage with ideas and encourage our news desk to let us, I suppose. So I believe you're willing to take questions from the floor. So if people have questions, now is the time.
Sure. Arvo T's 2:30. We're inside. Yep, at the back. Thank you. One of the things I left out, you'll be glad to hear I left some things out, was a defense of cliches, because we all use them and we all need to use them. The reason is that they are compressed ways of saying a certain thing. And once they appear, they're a marker to us, oh, that's what's meant here. So we need not be worried about it. We need to defend cliches. However, what worries me often is the impression that some journalists give, if I may say, of being lazy, of not thinking through issues, of simply taking what was there already and retailing it. And I think as you use the cliches, you ought to challenge them in your mind and ask, now, is it true? Is all that's being passed on here true? Or does it need to be challenged? Should I be saying something novel? I know that's an odd thought, but on the news page. Like the brilliant speaker and leader, Brian Houston of Hillsong. Something like that, rather than the whatever the cliches are. Yep. He's a good speaker. Yep. Thank you. Yes, I have been maliciously defamed by the media, I believe. You've set me going. Brothers and sisters, our first duty is to love our neighbour as ourselves. And I try, when I speak to someone from the media, to regard them as a human being doing a job, and to be aware of the difficulties under which they labour, and to make all allowances possible for the Babel problem of getting things across. And therefore, I have tried to make it a habit of not complaining. Now, I've broken that twice so far. Both over very, very massive things. Now, interestingly, one of them, which was, as I say, in my view, maliciously defamatory, I had been praying for the author of that article following what I thought was a lovely conversation I'd had. And he's in my book, and I pray for him. And I have to say, I found it much more difficult to pray for him. But I've got back to doing it. Because after all, he too is a human being. He too is earning his living. He too needs the Lord the same way as I do. And I've, you know, if you knew as much about me as I now know about him, well, you might regard me as beyond the pale too. So we've got to be, yeah, we've got to love others, in other words. But it did give me a month or two of grief, which I hope I've now passed beyond. Okay, someone else. Yes, sir. Thank you. Do I need to repeat these questions?
Yes.
Oh, I do beg your pardon. I want to repeat this one because it contains something I want to comment on particularly. I'll put it, I hope I got it right, despite my concern for getting the gospel out, do I think that the church still has a role to play in commenting strongly about things such as workplace reforms and so forth and so on? Now, I'm glad about this question because it gives me an opportunity to correct something or to say again what I said just to make sure that it's in everyone's minds. I don't draw a distinction between those two things. I want to comment on workplace relations in a way that is gospel-oriented, that does get the gospel out. So, yes, I'm very happy to. But you see, on workplace reforms and so forth, there's the question of human relationships. Human relationships are central to the gospel. So I'm very happy to comment on. But I want to be able to clearly make the link so that people can see that I'm speaking as a Christian here, not just as a secularist. Because my funny Christian accent is turned into a secular accent the minute it hits the media. That's what happens to me again and again. So that's what I would say. I'm doing the same thing. At the back, yeah. Thanks, Graham. Okay, Graham's made the important practical suggestion that denominational churches have access, if possible, if allowed, to the training of young journalists so that journalists then have some sense of what, you know, what an archbishop is and what... Don't think I'm obsessed with this. I wasn't sure myself, actually, but, you know, some sense of the structure of the organisation so that... If I have been critical of that, I hope you heard me say, I understand that it would be impossible for a young person particularly to know all these things without that experience. And I didn't realise that was a possibility. It's a good suggestion. Someone over here, yes. Thank you. The question is, have I ever been surprised at what I've been asked to comment on, and does that reflect something of the church's place in the community? Yeah, I have to say in general terms, I can't think of a particular thing. I have to say in general terms, I have been astonished at the range of opportunities to comment that have been afforded me by the media, and delighted. Because I think I don't like it personally. I don't actually much like going into media things. I like being here with you. I love that. But, you know, it's not my natural milieu. But, boy, the opportunities I've had some knocks and I've had some, you know, very hard times, and sometimes some private grief, but it, to my view, it's been worth it. I'll tell you why. I met a lady once who said to me, she said, "Oh, I went to the staff room the other day and they were all bagging you out about what the Herald had said you'd said." And she said, "I agreed with them, so I got stuck into you too, but it was a wonderful opportunity for the gospel." Thanks a lot. I've had a lot of those sort of comments. My biggest surprise, however, and this is not on your question, my biggest surprise was when a certain lady, journalist, asked me on the television one day, homosexuality was the debate again, and she said to me, "And what's the Bible got against pelicans?" Yeah, anyhow. I think she was badly briefed somehow. Yep. We're all aware of the comment that turns into a question at the end. Thank you, that's brilliant. Yes, it is what I'm trying to challenge folk to do. Don't be just saying, "Oh, well, it's the part two bit, that's the only bit I can report on." Use your ingenuity to weave part one into the part two comment. And that's it. Thank you very much. I think that's a brilliant thing to do, and I challenge you to do it. At the back. Do I think that conflict between church leaders impacts negatively for the church? On the whole, yes, and there's been far too much of it in the past. Sometimes it's inevitable to stand up for the truth. Sometimes one has got to stand up for the truth in public. We try, as a matter of principle, amongst the church leaders to contact each other and talk first and that sort of thing, and so as to prevent such matters arising. However, the key to my mind is speaking the truth in love. And so if I do, it is a well-known fact that Archbishop Pell and I disagree with each other about some pretty fundamental things. But we both try to speak well of each other while we're dissenting from each other. And I don't know if it works, but I think is a way of doing things. To give up every opportunity for disagreement would, I think, be a big mistake, because sometimes the truth comes out of those disagreements. But certainly I do feel sometimes that our church people wash their dirty linen in public as a way of getting at others, that breaches 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and is very unfortunate. 2:30, I don't go a second beyond what I'm paid
I was going to suggest that we had one more question.
One more question from this lady here?
Yes. Or worst?
Oh, sure. Yes, thank you. Of course there is. It's the world, the flesh and the devil. And particularly the world and the devil, so to speak, in the sense that the evil one loves misinformation. He is the father of lies and he loves to put those lies out. So even if you occupy a lowly place in some media organisation, the simple task of truth... We're not trying to defend each other, you know, and to do favours, but nonetheless, just making sure the truth is there is very, very helpful indeed. Mind you, even the present situation of not very good media at a number of points, I may be wrong, but I still prefer it to the absolutely quiescent, non-appearance, "Oh, you're all about the Salvation Army," thing that characterised the 80s and the 90s. So I'd rather be out there fighting and getting trashed but people are still able to use what I'm saying, or even what I'm alleged to say, to spread the gospel. However, on the other side, let me say, as I said in the course of this paper, great harm has been done by malicious, ill-founded, untrue things that have been said, and we certainly do have the other side to it. It's not easy. Yep.
Okay.
But I'm in it.
I think we ought to thank Peter again for coming to speak to us.